very enlightening. It was a lovely, lovely presentation and a very tough act to follow. Thanks.
Okay, our next paper is going to be close to African studies, but from an Egyptian, more of a recent Egyptian background, by our colleague Mary Ghattas. And without further ado, go ahead, Mary.
Okay, let me figure out how to share the screen. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It's really wonderful to be here virtually with you all today. I'm happy that we were still able to have this conference, so thank you, Henny, for that. So the basis of this present study picks up where some of my previous work left off. During my MA studies a while ago, I examined the ecclesiastical relations between the Coptic and Nubian churches during the late antique and early Middle Ages. The nature of these relations, as you all know, is a very fine juncture of religion and politics, which in this particular case was a delicate balance between two ultimately diametrically opposed belief systems, subsequently each with its own particular worldview, which ultimately drove both interest and strategy in obtaining said interest. All the while, the ethos of one allows for and even feeds into the ambition of the other. The research project concluded, as again you all know, open-endedly because research only begets more research. The official ecclesial relationship ended in 1372 with the sudden death of the last Coptic bishop ordained for Nubia, a native Nubian named Bishop Timotheos, whose ordination was a break from the typical practice of ordaining an Egyptian, as we see commanded by the Arab Nicene canons for places like Nubia and Ethiopia. Bishop Timotheus' burial suggests the last Coptic bishop ordained for Nubia had a short tenure, a suddenly and possibly violent death, and a secret and hasty burial. The official scrolls confirming the bishop's legitimate ordination and enthronement provide us the very last surviving connection between the Nubian church and the Coptic church. The study concluded with questions that seemed to splinter the very scaffolding of the project. We see throughout this period of study an expectation of the Coptic patriarch as a political player. He's the public figure whose norm is to execute the interests of the state. And even it goes so far as to punish him when he's uncooperative. We also see the politicization of an ecclesial communion, which for the dates examined again is a very normal reality, seeing that church and state blend these modern day borders. We see a non-Egyptian church headed by an Egyptian bishop. We see fear grip the rulers of Egypt because of this ecclesial communion, which they in turn attempt to mold to fit their agenda. These same themes seem ever present in this study, and although it's set from 1805 to the present day, and thus it's a very different period characterized by very different trends, nationalism, the separation of church and state, and secularism. This time the focus is between the Coptic and Ethiopian churches in an attempt to bring greater understanding to the Oriental Orthodox communion as sister churches begin to critically engage their past. The Coptic and Ethiopian churches provide a parallel in this communion to Syriac Indian churches, and maybe the history is similar, maybe there are similar themes, more research will tell. For many centuries, care for the Ethiopian church was the responsibility of the Coptic Church, and it was an important extension of the St. Mark's jurisdiction. This relationship can also be considered a historical precedence for work for the mission work of the Coptic Church in Africa, as both the Nubian and Ethiopian communion provide an ancient foundation for this activity. The Coptic Church's relationship with the Ethiopian Church is venerably ancient and historical, and it's largely during our bookend time period today of 1805 to the present, it's centered on questions of autocephaly and the delicate juncture of political and ecclesiastical diplomacy. Within these two sections, I hope to address the modern trends that have affected the thought and action behind these three issues and how they're played out. However, there are a few things that I will not be addressing in this presentation. I won't be addressing questions of nomenclature, race, or communal life. And because I seek to cover the modern and postmodern periods, I won't be teasing out what area ancient or medieval sources call Ethiopia or dispute its borders. It's safe to assume that today's borders as they stand are Ethiopia. For the background instances of Ethiopia that I mentioned to build up to autocephaly and ecclesial diplomacy, I will relay the ones that are indisputably Ethiopia from the sources. I won't be concerned with reading issues of race in the study unless it is present. And mainly because I do not believe that the Coptic Church's activity in Nubian Ethiopia can be characterized, at least initially, as colonial. Both ecclesiastical relationships arose from a pastoral need. However, it's entirely possible that this relationship does develop a race factor, a colonial factor, but that would have to be evidenced to include it in the study. And as for communal life, unfortunately, the sources I've encountered so far on the topic portray a religious or economic factor to Ethiopian communal presence in Egypt. It seems largely limited to monks, seminarians, probably a lot less now that Addis Ababa has its own theological colleges, and economic refugees either in Egypt en route to the US or Canada, or in Egypt to seek better economic opportunity. The picture of communal life is possibly more varied, even though it seems as if the Ethiopian communion worships alongside Copts in their churches, or they don't have churches of their own in Egypt. But if anyone knows anything about that, please pass on the information. More research on the matter is definitely needed. And before discussing autocephaly and ecclesiastical diplomacy, I'd like to briefly consider the background to this time period. As the Oriental Communion is not a chance anti-Chalcedonian alliance, it's rather a true communion, one that is nourished with encounter and exchange in culture, and at times even political advocacy. A common Christological position post-Chalcedon definitely provides the foundation for this communion, but contact between the two churches remains unbroken post-Chalcedon to today, even if at times communication was laborious. Almost immediately post-Chalcedon, the Ethiopian church declared its theological adherence to the Coptic position. The Ethiopian church exercised leadership even beyond its borders during the Yemenite wars in pre-Islamic Arabia. With the advent of Islam, Ethiopian Christians established friendly relations with Muhammad and the early caliphs. Hostilities began when Arabs settled on the African shores of the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. What happened then is a lot of the Ethiopian Christians flee to the highlands. From 650 to 1270, all external relations of the Ethiopian church are limited to the Coptic church. This was a dark period for the Ethiopian church, as the very existence of even this communion is tenuous. It's threatening to come to an end with after the ordination of one metropolitan Abuna or another. Cyril II of Alexandria, the 67th patriarch who ruled from, or who was patriarch from 1077 to 1093, fulfilled his patriarchal duty by uniting the churches of the Oriental Orthodox family, or what today we call the Oriental Orthodox family. During his reign in the 11th century, the bishops of the Armenian, Syrian, Ethiopian, and Nubian churches gathered together in the Egyptian capital and confessed the Orthodox upright faith, quote, on which the saintly fathers agreed, and with which Nestorius and Leo and the Council of Chalcedon disagreed, end quote. By calling for this gathering, the Patriarch of Alexandria strengthened the church by emphasizing doctrinal unity. By uniting on doctrinal matters, all involved bishops also strengthened their bonds towards one another, and in the process, complicated state alliances. Cyril II's reign began with the consecration of a certain Cyrus as Archbishop of Ethiopia. Cyrus was a seasoned politician and ecclesiastic who conferred with Badr al-Jamali, the Fatimid vizier of Egypt, who was of Armenian extraction himself. So he conferred with Badr al-Jamali over the Egyptian policy towards Ethiopia. The vizier sought to build mosques for Ethiopia's Muslims and to assure safe conduct for Egyptian merchants. Cyrus sanctioned the restoration of 7 mosques that Ethiopian Christians had destroyed, But Egyptian merchants continued to be subjected to seizure and pillage. Badr al-Jamali then summoned Cyril II, whom he openly rebuked and requested to, quote, act sternly with his Abyssinian co-religionists, end quote. This was a serious problem for Cyril. It was eventually decided to dispatch two bishops to the Ethiopian court in an attempt to rectify the situation. Apparently no satisfactory solution was reached, and this story remains indicative of the position of the Coptic Patriarchate in international affairs. The Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt abused the Copts and consequently aroused their Ethiopian co-religionists to relieve their distant brethren from increasing pressure. Whenever news of persecution had reached the Ethiopian monarch, he resorted to one or more of three retaliatory measures. The first, he threatened to deflect the course of the Nile, which would turn Egypt into a desert. Two, he would negotiate by an exchange of gifts. An example of this, we see King David I sent 22 camels laden with gifts to Sultan Barkuk, the first sultan of Egypt's Borji Mamluk dynasty. And the third measure he would take on, if and only if the previous two items failed, the king simply took severe reprisals against Ethiopian Muslims, who he often regarded as hostages in the country. Even going so far as to express the intention to invade Egypt from the south and thus throw off the Islamic yoke, as King Zara Yaqub, who reigned from 1438 to 1468, expressed. This same king appointed the abbot of the Ethiopian monastery in Jerusalem and another unnamed Ethiopian delegate to attend the Council of Ferrara Florence from 1438 to 1439, alongside Ioannis, the Coptic abbot of St. Anthony's Monastery on the Red Sea. While Ethiopian relations with Western Europe were gradually becoming more frequent during this period, the strength of the ecclesial communion between Ethiopia, the Ethiopian Church and the Coptic Church, seemed to deter any serious attempts from foreign Catholic missions between the 15th and 17th centuries. Apart from one Portuguese Jesuit mission in the mid-17th century and one almost French mission in the beginning of the 18th century, Ethiopia was largely closed off. The 19th century ushered in an era of complete isolation due to internal intrigues, assassinations, and unrest. Externally, again, in the 19th century, relations were once again limited to Egypt, which now occupied the Sudan in the west, and the Italians who controlled Eritrea to the east, and the two would continue to be involved in the process of obtaining autocephalous status for the Ethiopian church. Ethiopia was hard to reach. It was beyond the reaches of the known world, considered exotic. The delegates at Ferrara Florence were certainly viewed as exotic. Furthermore, Ethiopia seemed unperturbed by the rest of the world. Its Christianity was drawn from the earth, deeply mystical tradition. And for example, as when the Arabs settled on the coast, Ethiopian Christians fled to the mountains and lived out an interior life there, inadvertent to the whirlwind of the world. Foreign missions seemed blocked out because of this unfamiliarity, and they in turn were regarded with fear and suspicion of motives by the Ethiopians. This same fear and suspicion of motives we could eventually apply to the Copts in their modern relations with the Ethiopians. Nationalism seems too simple an answer when considering Ethiopian autocephaly. The process itself begs the question of the quality of Egyptian ecclesial leadership and its ethos, and ultimately the leverage of the Egyptian state. Meret Boutrousrelli claimed that this was the first time in Christian history that a church gained independence from another, to use the political term. Should this claim be substantiated, it's possible that the desired outcome was not completely understood, and it leaves the Copts with a new political reality to navigate. As we will later on see, autocephaly hardly changed the reasons for later ecclesiastical diplomacy, the nature of the historic problems between Egypt and Ethiopia remained despite the changes of the era, namely a separation of church and state and secularism. The question of providing a greater number of bishops, more than one abuna, one metropolitan for the Ethiopian see, is reported to have been broached as early as the 12th century, when Emperor Haile of the Zagwe dynasty asked for 10 bishops to assist the then Abuna Michael. The then Patriarch Gabriel II, who was patriarch from 1131 to 1165, considered the request reasonable and justified. But the ruler of Egypt is said to have prevented the appointment of additional bishops in order to keep the Church of Ethiopia under the Church of Egypt and consequently under the ruler of Egypt. This same thought seems to permeate the position of the Egyptian state throughout the process of Ethiopian church autocephaly, and even after. We can note as recent as, I want to say it was June 2013, Pope Tewodros was involved in talks with Ethiopia regarding Ethiopia's Grand Renaissance Dam, a source of recent anxiety to Egypt. The request of multiple bishops to assist the spiritual head of the Ethiopian church was denied until 1881. Until then, the high church dignitary, and forgive me for butchering this mispronunciation, the Echege, stood between the Egyptian Abuna, the metropolitan, and the rest of the Ethiopian church. He served as a liaison between the imperial court and the clergy with the ecclesial authority of a priest. Traditionally, abbots of Ethiopia's most venerable monasteries served this position, presiding over church councils alongside the king and the abuna, the metropolitan, and participating in councils that dealt with matters of state. There seemed to be a system of checks and balances in place, as the high church dignitary could be dismissed from his office at any time at the demand of the Society of Monks of the Debre Libanos monastery, which is the monastery founded by Saint Tecla Himenot. The existence of this office begs the question, again, of the quality of Coptic leadership in a tradition grounded in pastoral care, which we can say characterizes the Coptic church today. How distant was this abuna from the Ethiopian people or from, you know, matters of the Ethiopian state? There seemed to not be an apparatus in place to train the archbishop before enthroning him in Ethiopia, which would be of pastoral and even diplomatic importance. Only two figures in the 20th century were able to function as both abuna and high church dignitary. One was a certain Abuna Sawiris, and another, his name was Abuna Basilius. So in 1881, going back to 1881, Cyril V consecrated three bishops along with the Abuna, the Metropolitan, for the Ethiopian church. One of the three bishops succeeded the Abuna when he passed away, but then the successor's death in 1926 and Cyril's death the following year halted the process of ordaining another Metropolitan for Ethiopia. John XVIII appointed four bishops in addition to the Abuna in 1929, and during his pastoral visit to Ethiopia the following year, ordained the high church dignitary as bishop. These first instances of meeting the Ethiopian church's needs evidence that neither the request for more bishops nor the request for native bishops went unheeded by the Coptic church. In 1935, with the Italian occupation and Emperor Haile Selassie's exile, the Italians attempted to persuade Abuna Kyrillos to declare the Ethiopian church independent from the Coptic church. Not even a stormy interview with Mussolini in Rome could dissuade him. He was then brought back to Egypt, and the Italian authorities appointed a certain Abraham as patriarch with three archbishops and three bishops to assist him. This ordination was declared non-canonical by the Synod of the Coptic Church in 1937, and the diplomatic relations between the two countries were halted until 1942. On the other side of the equation, the Egyptian state quite deftly blocked the process of autocephaly through negotiations, representation in papal elections and synod meetings, an outright breach of privilege granted to Ethiopian participants in Coptic papal elections and ordinations. Tempted by the opportunity to move hands in a Christian state, the Egyptian government's misunderstanding of the ethos of this ecclesial communion many times left the Coptic patriarch in a sensitive and difficult position. Ethiopians often countered the argument that their number was much larger than the Copts in Egypt, and they were not headed by a majority Muslim state. They were rather a majority in a state that officially proclaimed Christianity as the state religion. When during the 1944 negotiations, a position similar to the ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople was suggested for the Patriarch of Alexandria, Egyptians could not seem to accept that the head of the See of St. Mark could become two persons. The ecclesial nuances were lost on state authorities, and church authorities equated autocephaly with the loss of patriarchal status. While the Ethiopian position ensured patriarchal status following a first among equals model. In 1951, Patriarch Yoseb II ordained the first Ethiopian Abuna Basilius, who in turn set about ordaining his own bishop, creating an Ethiopian synod. While this was indeed a major step, it was not autocephaly. It was delegated authority with the Coptic Patriarch directing the Ethiopian church through an Ethiopian Abuna. Ethiopian demands to the Coptic Synod during the Patriarchate of Yoseb were made on extremely anxious and uncertain grounds, given the turmoil around Yoseb's own deposition. This deposition made the status of the Ethiopian Abuna's extremely tenuous, and Ethiopians were not consulted at all in the matter of Yoseb's deposition, which was outrageous to them. Their demands included equal synodal representation and equal votes in papal elections while foregoing that the Abuna be Ethiopian. He would instead be granted vice patriarch status once a Coptic patriarch was elected and would be obligated to make a state visit to Ethiopia after his consecration. In a letter Pope-elect Father Mina al-Mutawahid sent to Haile Selassie in preparation for his papal ordination in April 1959, Father Mina hoped that the Ethiopian delegation would share in his consecration by laying their hands on his head. This was an unprecedented request, it had never been done before, no one had ever suggested it before. But Father Mina's wish did embody the ethos of the ecclesial relationship. It was an act of kenotic ecclesiology, and this term is taken from Father Seraphim al-Baramosi's work on the same by the same title. It's used by Father Daniel Fenouz's work on Cyril the Sixth, which I'm sure a lot of you are very familiar with, the book that came out in November last year. Kenotic ecclesiology suggests a self-emptying approach to pressing ecclesial issues and even ethical issues in the church that come up with solutions. And here I'm going to add regardless of state interest. Father Mina's wish, unfortunately, never materialized. President Nasser had perceived the significance of this wish and went so far as to forcibly remove any member of the Ethiopian delegation from the event. I think if we were to even look at photos of Patriarch Cyril the Sixth ordination, we wouldn't find a member of the Ethiopian delegation. Cyril the Sixth was not deterred. 6 weeks following his ordination, he declared the autocephalous status of the Ethiopian Church and its Archbishop as Patriarch Katholikos. His practical kenotic ecclesiology would also play out in the issue of ownership of Deir es-Sultan in Jerusalem, which I unfortunately today will not be able to open that can of worms. Autocephaly did not, contrary to previous thought, lead to a break in relations between the Coptic and Ethiopian churches. It certainly didn't change the issues between the two states. If anything, autocephalous status is still being negotiated, especially when considering relations with the Eritrean Church. diplomacy between the two countries centered for so long on the two churches. The Egyptian state never hesitated to dispatch the Coptic patriarch to talk with Ethiopia over a border issue, a Nile issue, or the treatment of Muslims in Ethiopia. Historically, this was limited to particularly Egyptian Muslim merchants, although the late ex-president Morsi meant Ethiopian Muslims in his agenda. So that nuance was lost in that particular case. In 1856, Khedive Sa'id called upon Cyril VI to undertake an important official mission in Ethiopia on his behalf to negotiate the borders. Emperor Theodoros gave the patriarch a warm welcome, but very shortly afterwards, news arrived that Sa'id was threatening to invade Ethiopia. So thinking that the patriarch was in a joint conspiracy of sorts, he flew into a rage and commanded his men to burn the patriarch alive. Only the queen's intervention saved Cyril. Emperor Theodoros was eventually convinced of Cyril's good faith and intentions, and he set him at liberty. This mission took the patriarch 18 months. This particular incident evidences that the rulers of Egypt depended on this ecclesial communion to keep Ethiopia in their back pockets, while a separation of church and state is an arguable reality in today's Egypt and is a bit questionable in Ethiopia's as well. Sending the Coptic patriarch and playing up ecclesiastical bonds and diplomacy is a move that left the patriarch no room to embody the ethos of his theology. And maybe in not this particular case with Patriarch Cyril IV and Emperor Theodoros, a lot of times these diplomatic missions left the emperor had to sheepishly comply with the hierarchy in order to not threaten the supply of Ethiopian church leadership. Church histories, again, record other diplomatic missions of this nature. Until 1929, the office of an Egyptian ambassador or consul to Ethiopia did not exist. The office was created for a certain Farag Mikhail Musa Bey at the recommendation of Emperor Haile Selassie. Before that, diplomatic relations fell to the Coptic patriarch, as he had the double benefit of being an ecclesiastic well-loved and respected by Ethiopian leaders. Haile Selassie would treat Musa Bey with the same love and deep respect characteristically given to the representatives of the See of St. Mark. Other consulates in Ethiopia were not afforded the importance given to the Egyptian official, and they were not shy voicing their concerns. This importance was disproportionate to the number of Egyptians living in Ethiopia, or even Ethiopians intending to visit Egypt at the time, which is what a consulate would take care of. The Egyptian consul of Ethiopia was concerned with only two things: the Nile River and maintaining the ecclesial communion with the Coptic Church. Musa Bey's memoirs relay that, quote, any tension between the two churches was likely to become a stumbling block and to escalate to have a detrimental effect on the relationship between the two countries, end quote. He is said to have personally played an intermediary role in the ordination of five Ethiopian bishops in 1929. The other issue of monumental and recent importance between the two countries and churches remains the Nile River. Pope Tewodros' involvement in these talks came after the then President Morsi was advised to capitalize on this ancient relationship. Abuna Mateos, or Matthias, I think is his name, the Ethiopian hierarch, today's Ethiopian hierarch, was set to undertake a four-day trip to Egypt in June of 2013. Before that, Tewodros met with state officials to discuss the Nile file in anticipation of an ecclesiastical mediation. Abuna Matthias, postponed the trip, and Pope Tewodros expressed, I guess in a way to calm Egyptian anxieties, that the Ethiopian church used to be among the strongest authorities in the country, citing that an ecclesiastical mediation would not accomplish here what it historically had the potential to do. Later in 2014, Pope Tewodros met with an Ethiopian delegation who reassured him that Ethiopia's dam project would benefit all involved parties. Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt. While there is acknowledgement of a new changing world that does not depend on ecclesial or ecclesiastical diplomacy, here the Egyptian church still finds herself negotiating the reality of a delicate political situation. In 2012, Pope-elect, and at the time, Tewodros, before his enthronement, gave an interview during which he indicated that he planned to reverse the explicitly political role of his predecessor, Shenouda III. He's quoted saying that the most important thing is for the church to go back and live consistently within the spiritual boundaries, because this is its main work, spiritual work, Tewodros says. And his own non-involvement in politics was short-lived, mainly because he has to reassert his role at every turn, that of a spiritual leader first and foremost. So to conclude, Tewodros' position, recarving and reasserting the extent of his involvement at every turn, is an attempt to reclaim his right to live out the ethos of the faith. His reasserting his own spiritual boundaries will only continue as historically the Egyptian state has utilized the church's alliances, for lack of a, I'm going to use alliances here, not communion, because it's used as an alliance, to carry out its geopolitical interests. Observing the Coptic Ethiopian communion begs the question, are there other ecumenical relations being regulated and for what reasons? And on the other hand, are there ecumenical relations that could possibly threaten the state? This would require teasing out questions, again, of separation of church and politics even further. And if Islam is theocratic in nature, blending politics and religion in an age where the rest of the world seems to have separated the two spheres, can the Coptic church be truly free to carry out its spiritual functions? Is a real embodiment of ecclesial ethos and kinetic ecclesiology possible? And what role, if any, does the diaspora play? My previous project on Nubia unearthed an unfortunate fact, is that historically the Coptic Church was stifled in its own experience to be too concerned with Ethiopian affairs, apart from consecrating an archbishop every few years. When it was simply overwhelmed, Nubian affairs took a back seat. The same fact proves true in its dealings with the Ethiopian church and was strongly felt by the Ethiopians, who were left to assert their importance in the See of St. Mark. This growing resentment led to what was perceived by the Copts and the Egyptian state as a struggle for primacy, something that the Ethiopian church never outright stated, and in terms for negotiation was very careful to veer away from anything that smacked of primacy. It always gave primacy in deference to Alexandria in negotiations. Cyril VI played a key role in autocephaly by applying a kenotic ecclesiology over and above state interests, embodying the ethos of his tradition first and foremost, and solving matters of state through personal relationships. Today, Ethiopia's Grand Renaissance Dam project might strain state relations between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia, but time will tell whether the ecclesial relation will be duly affected and what new terms it will spell out for this communion. And thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Mary. We'll keep the questions after the session. Lisa, get ready.